Tansy.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order.
Good luck.
Colleagues, we're going to change up the schedule just a little bit today due to personal requests, trying to accommodate my colleagues. So first, I'd like to have a public hearing on House Bill 2804. Victoria, would you give us a... I'm sorry I didn't warn you about that, did I? Would you give us a brief summary of the bill, please?
No problem, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2804 requires persons engaged in retail floral sales to disclose principal place of business, if not in Oregon. Makes violation an unlawful trade practice.
Thank you. And I think up first, we'd like to hear from the sponsor of the bill, Representative Kopp. Welcome to our committee this afternoon. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Representative Betty Kopp, and it's my pleasure to serve House District 22. I know it's Friday afternoon, and I will be brief, but we are certainly here. I have my constituent that has brought this issue to me that impacts businesses, floral businesses, and so with that, I will get to my testimony and so that we can move forward. I come to you today in support of House Bill 2804, which would require a business engaging in floral retail sales to disclose the location of their business, and particularly when in advertising. Currently, a business can be anywhere in a region and advertise their business with different local phone numbers, possibly giving a false impression to consumers. The issue mentioned in this bill first came to my attention thanks to the passion of Cindy Werner Kelly, who you'll hear from. She is a constituent of Woodburn as well as a local business owner in our district. Cindy is one of 90,000 plus small business owners in the state of Oregon and one of 88,000 women business owners in Oregon. We would like to make sure that all of you know that small businesses in our communities, small communities make a big difference, and Cindy makes that difference for us. She does that by employing local residents and using their expertise and ideas that has an impact for all of us every day in our own backyard. I bring you this bill not only because I believe in protecting Cindy's local business and consumers in Woodburn, but also I feel that it is vitally important, especially in these economic hard times, to protect all businesses. And with that, I'm going to close my testimony, and I will be here with Cindy. And we did find that we're probably going to, we're going to need to bring a very one-phrase amendment to this bill. We missed a point, but we'll talk to you about that after Cindy gives her testimony.
Dear Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing me to be here today. My name is Lucinda A. Werdinger Kelly. I'm a resident of Woodburn, Oregon. I own a retail florist shop in Woodburn. I've been in the floral nursery industry since 1972 when I was just 12 years old. My comments today are directed in support of House Bill 2804, the Commercial Law Deceptive Trade Practices Act. As you know, the bill would make unfair trade practice to knowingly misrepresent the geographic origin or location of a business. It also requires that whenever someone uses the name of a locality in its business name, such as Woodburn Florist, Hubbard Florist, Kaiser Florist, Salem Florist, etc., the actual address of the business must be disclosed in any telephone directory and assistance services. In June of 2007, I was so excited to open our new telephone directory to view my display ad. To my dismay, I was saddened to see a new shop listing using my business name, Woodburn Florist, with a local 982 Woodburn prefix. No address was listed as to the new shop's physical address. I called the phone number to see where they were located. After some convincing, an employee told me they were located in Waukesha, Wisconsin. They were curt and rude. In fact, they hung up on me when I asked too many questions about their customer deception of their location in the Woodburn area. On July 24th, a regular customer of ours, Betty Jean Wallace, came into our store very upset that we did not fill her order to value on a planter basket that she had ordered over the phone for a July 24th funeral service. She was so upset, and after I spoke with her, we came to find out that the order was not placed with us. She called Woodburn's Best Floral, a listing she found in our local Woodburn phone book, thinking it was our shop. The numbers listed as a local phone number, and the employee who spoke with her made it sound as if she was talking to somebody and that they were actually in Woodburn. The order was picked up by the shop in Wisconsin and then rerouted through 1-800-Flowers and delivered by a shop in Salem. After talking to the Salem shop, we found her order was taken for $75 and filled for $40. Upon many such complaints against the company, the Department of Justice shut down the cut-in line operation and 120 phone numbers in the state of Oregon. These telemarketing companies have taken out ads and phone directories in many large and small markets in Oregon. They often represent themselves as local businesses by printing a local phone number and a fictitious local-sounding company names that call forward to an order-gathering center in another state. The order, less a fee and a commission, is then wired to the local florist to fill and deliver. These deceptive ads do not give the business address. The customer is unaware that their order is being handled out of state and their tax dollars are not going to Oregon. House Bill 2804 would put an end to these deceptive practices by requiring the company to list their address in the yellow and white pages of the phone books. The consumer may then make an informed decision of where they would like to spend their money. Although financial losses are difficult in any retail florist to swallow, perhaps the most disturbing thing about this deceptive trade practice is the impact on the customer. The out-of-state company deceives people into feeling as if they were ordering flowers the way they've done for years, namely calling a local retail florist. But these are not the same kinds of transactions. Companies that run nationwide 800 numbers make it quite clear to the consumer that they are national marketers. Once consumers know this, they can make a reasonable decision about where they want to buy their flowers. But when you cross the barrier to where consumers don't have a reasonable way to differentiate between an existing local business and one that claims to be local, then that's an unethical, deceptive business practice. What can be done about this? First, I respectfully urge this committee to move this bill forward. I applaud my district representative, Betty Comp, for bringing this issue to the attention of the state legislature. Second, I ask you to consider what's happening in other states across the nation. Washington State already has a law putting an end to this deceptive trade practice, and many other states, including Connecticut, Delaware, Florida, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Maine, Michigan, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Ohio, South Carolina, South Dakota, Texas, Tennessee, and Virginia. And third, as you deliberate over this issue, I ask you to put yourselves in the shoes of the local retail florist. The vitality of many communities across the country, whether it's a small town or a large metropolitan area, depends on the vitality of the schools, churches, governing bodies, and, of course, the businesses that operate within those boundaries. Those businesses provide goods and services to the public, and they also offer employment opportunities, pay taxes to support the local community, and create a spirit that helps hold communities together. That spirit is being threatened by the deceptive trade practices that House Bill 2804 hopefully will end. Once again, I encourage you to support this legislation. Thank you guys for the opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any question, Representative what's your name? Widener.
Yes, Friday.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chair.
Wow.
Cindy, thank you for coming here today. This is the exact same thing we need to be battling, because these are the kind of businesses that we need to be weeding out, so the ones that are being deceptive. And I thank you for bringing this to our attention. And thank you, Betty, for working this for.
Representative Reiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to, do anything to cause this bill problems, but is there a reason that we don't, extend this same thing? Why is it just floral retail sales and not all other sales.
Well, thank you, Representative Riley, Mr. Chair, Representative Riley. In reviewing the bill again once today, that exact thought came to my mind. And since we're going to have to do a little bit of a technical amendment anyway, if the committee so wants to expand it to notification about other businesses, I mean, that's not an issue to add to this.
It is prevalent in the insurance industry. It happens, and there's, I'm sure, a lot of other ones
the
as
others,
well.
Yes.
Anything that's telephone-based?
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Yeah, I know of several businesses that have this problem. In my home, in my town, we have a bead store that has this problem. There are many, many retail type of businesses that actually have this very same problem. So I'd like to see it expanded.
In a minute.
And Mr. Chair, I have a comment.
Comment?
Thank you. And committee, the reason why we did just the four when we started this, and that is because we used the base of the statute that other states had used in the floral industry. So that was the language and stuff that we started with.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure to whom this question should go, but I don't understand what cut-in-line operation and 120 phone numbers is.
1-800 phone numbers.
That's in your testimony.
You'd like.
I'm asking of this.
Oh, it's 120 phone numbers. In 07, when I opened the phone book, there was a company from Wisconsin that had taken our business name and just put Best in the middle of it, so it was Woodburn Best Floral. And then they also took Hubbard Best Floral, Kaiser Best Floral, Salem Best Floral. And there were 120 of those phone numbers throughout the state by the same company in Wisconsin. Yeah. So not only does it hurt our business, but it also takes tax dollars away from Oregon because they're just routing it the money right out of the state. And then they're sending it back to us through those 800 phone companies or those order gatherers. And the clearinghouses route the orders back, and then they keep a huge commission where the order originated, which would have been in Wisconsin. And in this case, they were even keeping more than the normal 20% cut, and the consumer was being affected because her order should have been filled at $75 value, but was only filled at $40. And that's what brought it to our attention. She came in and was just really upset.
Sure.
You know, she got this little planner basket when she was expecting something.
$70.
Right, and she was a regular customer, so she knew what kind of work we did.
Back into another follow-up. Thank you. So how much of your business is transacted over the phone?
Well, probably 75% of it.
Great.
Now it's changing, though, because of the Internet and whatnot. But still, they still look on the Internet, and they can get our phone numbers. So I don't know. I think it's huge.
But very little coming into your place. Usually it's either Internet or phone.
Right.
Is that correct? Okay,
right.
Thank you.
Representative Riley?
One part of Representative Tomei's question was, what is cut-in line? Do you want to explain what that is?
Well, they just cut in with the local phone number that they can just purchase. And the phone company doesn't make them step up to the plate and put their address in.
Yeah, actually, what this probably means, thank you if I can follow up. Actually, what this means is there's a service that phone companies have which allow you to automatically transfer from one line to another. It costs a little extra to get that service, but if you dial my home while I'm down here, I could have my phone dial my cell phone, and that's what cutting line is. It cuts in and redirects.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Wingard?
Senator, thanks for coming today. Help me understand what we need to do in addition to what is already happening. From your letter, it looks like the Justice Department moved in and brought some action against these folks. So I guess I'm wondering what additional remedy. I mean, it looks to me like what they did may have already violated the law, and that brought the Justice Department in. So I'm wondering what we need to do in addition to
that. We need to set the law because it's not set, which made them able to come in and do that. And the Department of Justice got involved because they were deceiving the customer by lying to them. And there was more than one occasion where the consumer was lied to. They just flat out said, we are in Woodburn, but we don't have a storefront. We're in a warehouse. And they flat out lied to her. And so that's how the Department of Justice got involved, because they were being deceptive.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you contacting your state legislator with this issue and for following through and bringing it through and taking the time out of your day to stand up for what you think is right and I think what a lot of us probably agree with. I appreciate your efforts. And Representative Comp, thank you.
Well, and just a final statement, Mr. Chair and Committee. We are really lucky to have business owners like Cindy. I mean, when she said she has started working with flowers and gardening since the age of 12, she means it. And the quality of her product is beyond, you cannot ever question or doubt her product. It is incredible, and we all know it. And then when you have somebody from a different entity come in and try to pass that off with a much, much lesser grade of product, it's offensive. And so I when Cindy brought the issue to me, I said, you bet we'll do something about this. So thank you for your time.
I appreciate it. I think I'm not going to move this bill today. I was prepared to, but I might like to have a conversation about what other businesses or industries might be applicable to this particular issue, because I think it may, in fact, be a little bit broader than the floral industry. I'm not opposed to just moving it with the floral industry if that's what we end up with, but I want to at least have that conversation.
Thank you. I agree, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2804. Next up, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 328. Victoria, would you give us a brief description of Senate Bill 328, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 328 subjects persons who engage in unlawful collection practices to the provisions of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act.
Thank you. And I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 328 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
That is an appropriate motion. Wasn't the one I was expecting.
Oh, but, sorry. You want me to rescind it?
But no, I don't know that I can.
She can withdraw. She can withdraw her her motion.
You can have two motions, but she's back here when I introduce the other.
Okay.
Sorry. Can you? Do you know if we can postpone that motion?
I can rescind it.
You can withdraw.
Or two motions.
I rescind my motion to move Senate Bill 328 to the floor.
I'm sorry for the pause, but I was expecting somebody wanted to make a motion on an amendment, they told me. But
I do actually,
I think they may have changed their mind. I don't know.
He's a little slow.
He is very slow today. So, I don't know officially how do I note that her motion has been rescinded, withdrawn. Representative Tomei's motion has been withdrawn courtesy to...
she is previous.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my deep gratitude to my colleague for finally getting out of the way. I move...
You better be careful.
There's a nice view, but I just couldn't get to the chair. And I would like to move that we adopt the dash threes to Senate Bill 328.
Representative Gilliam moves that we adopt the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 328. Discussion? Uh-oh, I made a mistake. Oh.
No, you didn't. Okay.
I'm going to recess for just a moment.
You can always do that.
I think it was him.
I'll bring the House Committee back into order, and we are in work session on Senate Bill 328, and we have proceeded correctly. So, Representative Gilliam.
He made his motion.
Well, Mr. Chair, I asked for
discussion.
Yes, discussion. And I'm sure there's others that may want to discuss this, but I thought this offered an interesting and promising compromise to the issue that we heard. And if it's all right with the chair, I got an interesting memo handed to me that I thought might be helpful for the members to review while we're discussing this amendment. Would that be all right with the chair?
Your discussion?
Talk?
Is it all right to pass out this memo?
Give it to her.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, it's not a memo that we don't currently have?
Correct.
Well, thank you for getting this ahead to us ahead of time. Usually the chair would expect to have amendments and memos that we wish to consider given to him well before the committee meeting so that everybody can review these before coming to the committee meeting. But
which is only right and proper.
Mr. Chair, let me just say that the ones that I brought with me, I received from LC literally 10 minutes before the hearing. So
I noted the date.
I did my best for you.
I will recess so the members can review.
Thank you. Very good.
I'm ready.
executive session. Representative Gilliam, I note that the memo that comments that you've brought forward are from Jim Markey. Would you like him to come up and walk through this amendment for us? Is that what your intent or?
Yes, it is. And while he, if that's all right with the chair, while he comes up, it seems to me that the key words for me were behavior versus actual harm, and that's what this amendment's trying to get at. And I think I'd be interested in the comments both of Mr. Markey, but of course my colleagues, if we could get to a compromise that would give more teeth to the AG that he needs, the Attorney General, then I think it would be a great compromise. That is to say, you can't intentionally treat people the way we heard they were treated, versus trying to interpret or put the word harm into the mix. That to me was the main point that came out of this memo.
Mr. Markey.
You're talking about cash 3, right?
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Markey, representing the Oregon Collectors Association. First of all, let me apologize to the chair. I actually, the original intention of this memo wasn't to bring to this committee, but to hand to various members that were still undecided about this issue. And I apologize that the chair and some of the members didn't have this memo ahead of the committee meeting. We have been very concerned, as you know, about Senate Bill 328 and the possible unintended consequences of some of our folks who might make a mistake. We believe that this amendment, which I did speak to everyone about, and I believe everybody had the amendment well ahead of time, brings about a compromise that we think is fair and still protects people who might make inadvertent mistakes. The statutory definition of willful under Chapter 646 really was redefined in a court decision by the Oregon Supreme Court to mean, and I quote, no more than proof of ordinary negligence by a defendant in not knowing when it should have known. And we believe that that means that a mistake can be a violation of the law. Our attempt here, and as I talked to legislative counsel, was to require to leave the willful standard for the right of private action by consumers, just like it is today under the current law, so that there would be no higher standard for a consumer bringing an action. But for a violation to rise to the level of being a violation of the Unfair Trade Practices Act, it would have to be a person who intentionally engages in conduct that is unlawful under the 646-639, which is the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. Our intention here is to really only require that there be intent to enter into conduct that violates the law. So we're not asking that, and when I talked to counsel, I said, look, I want language here that does not raise the bar for the Attorney General to the level that he would ever have to prove intent to harm, because there are statutory provisions under, I think, in criminal law and even in indemnity cases, I think, where you have to prove intent, that the conduct was intentional and that there was also an intent to harm. And we asked counsel for language that would not rise to that level but would only be intentional as to the conduct. And that's what our attempt here is. We think it's reasonable, obviously. There are those who disagree with this. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Meara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, can you think of any other state statutes that require proof of intentional violations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I haven't done that research. I don't know. I really don't know. So I'd be happy to do the research for you if you'd like.
Yeah, I think my staff has tried to do that. We haven't found any. It's an interesting question. The other thing is, I'm one follow-up.
Follow-up, please.
If I go through a stop sign and I tell the police officer I had no intention of going through the stop sign, do you think I wouldn't get a ticket?
Mr. Chair, Representative Domeyer.
Yeah, let the police officer answer.
Might depend on the police officer. I'm not sure.
I think it's an interesting thing to think about. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you for bringing your memo forward.
Appreciate it.
I'd like to call up Keith Kajanovich. He's going to get it right.
We're going to have to help him with that one.
Good afternoon, Chair.
They have no faith that I've messed up your name so many times.
It's okay.
For the record, I said it right the last three times in a row.
Thank you. I think I was 14 before I could pronounce it, Chair.
So, and maybe you could just go over the bill, Senate Bill 328 for us, and give us your take on the Dash 3. I apologize for not having this memo for you to review ahead of time, but maybe you could comment the best you could on these and what the impacts to the bill would be.
Thank you, Chair Halvey, members of the committee. My name is Keith Kajanovich, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. We saw the Dash 3 amendments for the first time this morning as well, and in looking at them, I think it would be fair to summarize that if your intent is to kill Senate Bill 328, you ought to vote in favor of the Dash 3 amendments. In our view, it would essentially prevent the Department of Justice from enforcing the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. And let me explain. The existing law is that there must be a willful use of an unlawful collection practice for it to be a violation of the Act. And willful has been defined, just like it is under the UTPA, as a knowing violation. You knew or should have known that you were violating the law. Now, that's not a unique standard. Indeed, it is the standard that exists in virtually every civil statute that this legislature has passed. It was interesting, if you take a look at 2804, the bill that you just heard, 2804 contains the UTPA, and you'll see in subsections AA through JJJ cross-references to, I lost count, but somewhere over 35 statutes. And what the UTPA says in these provisions is that if you violate, doesn't say intentionally violate, if you violate one of these statutes, you have violated the UTPA. Now, what the Dash 3 amendments are seeking to do is impose upon the Department of Justice an obligation to get into the mind of the debt collector to figure out, did they intend to violate the Act, or was it just their pattern and practice of conduct? Was it a mistake? And unfortunately, getting into the intent of a defendant is extremely difficult. And it is done principally in criminal statutes. And that's because what's called the mens rea is very, very difficult to prove. Hence, when you look at the itemization in 2804, where if you violate one statute, doesn't say intentional, if you violate the statute, you're also violating the UTPA. It's because this legislature has decided that if somebody does something wrong in the law that you've defined, it is perceived to be an unlawful trade practice act violation. And I think, unfortunately, What it would result in is us having absolutely no enforcement ability over debt collection practices whatsoever.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener, Bruce.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. Couldn't you prove intent if someone was doing something wrong? You send out a letter saying cease and assist from doing this because it's illegal in law. And then if they continue to do it after you've sent a certified letter to them, wouldn't that be, at that point, they're intentionally doing it wrong?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, I wish it was that easy. They could respond, gee, didn't get your letter. Oh, sorry, it was an accident. We weren't
certified
able-
mail?
Believe it or not, we get that response from time to time.
But it's signed for at that
follow
point.
Follow up?
Sorry, follow up. So a certified letter means they had to sign to receive it.
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, you're absolutely right. Someone in the company received it. But if we send a letter to the office in Chicago, that doesn't mean that the people that are making the telephone calls in Atlanta or Detroit have gotten the message that they shouldn't be violating Oregon law. And that's why we can't be in a position of requiring proof of intent, because what it would require is not just proving that the company in Chicago knew that the law prevented them from threatening to throw somebody in jail, but that the person making the telephone call in Atlanta and Detroit knew that it was a violation of the law. And that's virtually impossible for us to do.
Representative Tomei was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll put the same question to you that I did to Mr. Marquis. Can you think of any state statutes that require proof of intentional violation?
Chair Holvey, Representative Tomei, the only statutes that I'm aware of are in the criminal context. For example, there are different levels of crimes depending upon the intent. You can have negligent homicide, for example, or if you kill someone with intent, that's generally considered to be first-degree murder or primary murder. But in the civil context, I'm not aware of a single statute that addresses intent as a predicate act to prove a violation of a statute.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am planning to vote against the proposed amendment, and I am planning to support the bill, Senate Bill 328, as originally drafted. I believe that a simple negligence standard is entirely appropriate in this kind of civil, this civil remedy, particularly in the case where it is designed to protect consumers. This just creates added incentive for the debt collector to not violate the law intentionally or otherwise. To avoid negligence, essentially. That said, this is an important industry. This is a difficult market, and prosecutorial discretion is always necessary. And Attorney General Kroger has looked me in the eye and told me that he intends to use this power we are granting him wisely and justly. I take the Attorney General at his word, and if that turns out to not be the case, if he is indeed using this to essentially go after or prosecute with potentially large sanctions, simple negligence claims, which I don't anticipate, I am prepared to reevaluate this in future legislation. And so thus, I would like to ask you, on behalf of the Department of Justice, if you can grant me the same. I assume by this power you are not planning to use this to prosecute or seek civil sanctions from simple negligence cases on a routine basis or anything but the most egregious instances.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barton, as the committee may remember, when we came in a couple of days ago and addressed how we approach our case handling, we indicated that in a vast majority of cases, we do not seek the maximum penalty of $25,000 per conduct. And indeed, the extraordinarily large number of complaints that we receive are resolved simply by us facilitating a conversation between the consumer and the business. And if that is not successful, then the rest of the complaints that we get are resolved directly between the Department of Justice and the business through an assurance of voluntary compliance, and they don't ever get to court. So I can assure the committee and Representative Barton that it is our intent to continue that course of conduct in working with business to resolve disputes with the consumer, whether it's a debt collection company or any other company.
Thank you. Just a question about that. I mean, because you mentioned that, you know, that these cases would, say, for example, you don't succeed at your voluntary compliance, or, and so you decide to proceed with a prosecution under the UTPA in this case. Does the Attorney General make the final determination of what the fine would be, or is that done by a court?
Chair Holvey, if we go to court and file actual lawsuits, we're treated just like any other litigant. We have to prove our case to a judge or a jury. And it is only after a judge or a jury determine that we have satisfied all of the elements of proof that they would then make a decision on what, if any, fine or penalty would be imposed. So the Department of Justice doesn't simply get to send a bill to a business and say, okay, now pay us $25,000. It's left up to a judge or a jury. And when such a penalty or fine is imposed, it does not come to the Department of Justice. It goes into the general fund just like any other fine or penalty that we recover.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go back to Representative Tomei's question, because your answer was very helpful, but
14.
I'm out of my depth in the legal area, unlike Representative Barton, but I wanted to be sure I understood this. I'm not sure of this term, something like predicative. But you said you don't know of any other statute that has intent, other than criminal, that has intent in that way. But are there statutes that do, in fact, that are not criminal, that do, in fact, take intent into consideration? I'm not trying to split too many hairs, but I want to make sure I understand your answer.
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, as I sit here, I cannot think of a single civil statute that takes into account intent. The one exception may be for punitive damages, where clearly intent or motivation is a factor in assessing the amount of the punitive damages.
Okay, that's helpful. And I have just a follow-up comment, if I could, for discussion, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
I appreciate Representative Barton's comments, but I would point out that I've sat here in this committee with two attorney generals. So the attorney general, who I believe, and the staff that's here today, I do tell the truth. However, it's a four-year term. So do we want to, just counterpoint, do we want to pass something that we get a promise from the Attorney General that assures us it's going to be the way that he says, only to have to readdress this issue in another administration? So that's the point on that.
Thank you. And, you know, I would just make the point that, you know, from my perspective in listening to this, we also have a judicial remedy in a court, you know, that also looks at these issues. So it's not a unilateral decision by the Attorney General's office. Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, I'm looking through the list of Unlawful Trade Practice Acts, and you know, I see a list of people who have consumer relationships. They're selling something. And I'm wondering if you recognize a difference between the relationship that a debt collector has than all of these other people who, in some way or another, this usually begins out as a positive experience. There's an attempt to make a fair exchange, and it seems to me that the rules in place for when it goes bad, but from the very beginning of the contact from a debt collector, the relationship is entirely different. My colleague, Representative Barton, referred to them as consumers. I'm not sure that in this particular case we really are talking about consumers. They may have been consumers at one time, but when they're dealing with the debt collector, they're really a debtor. And so I'm wondering if your office sees a difference between the debt collection industry and the, this list of all these other essentially retailers or product or service sellers in some way or another.
Chair Hovey, Representative Wingard, that's a very interesting point. You're correct. The so-called consumer is not purchasing something from the debt collector. And no doubt that when they are contacted by the debt collector, they're not eager to receive the call. And so as a consequence, when we receive a complaint from a consumer, we have to take that into account. That having been said, the legislature passed essentially the rules of the game in passing the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. We don't set the guidelines for what debt collectors are allowed to do and not allowed to do. You folks get to do that, and you've done that. All that we at the Department of Justice are seeking to do is enforce those rules that you folks have already passed. And at the present time, the rules are not being enforced. And it doesn't matter whether Mrs. Smith is happy to receive a call from a debt collector or not. The fact of the matter is that a debt collector is supposed to comply with the law, and that's all we're trying to do is enforce the law.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Thank you. You are correct. The legislature, previous legislatures, have set the rules of the game, and they also set the rules for remedy. So it seems to me that what your office is asking us to do is to change, to some degree, the rules of remedy. We're going to change the balance in this equation, which may or may not be a good idea. But, again, I think the point of the amendment is, it seems to me, is to recognize the difference between the relationship that a debt collector has with the consumer, which I hesitate to use because I don't think in this case they really are a consumer, and everyone else on this list who is attempting to sell a product or a service of some kind or another. And I'm, I guess the last thing I'd add is that I'm not sure I agree with your assessment that, that those of us who may support this amendment wish to kill Senate Bill 328.
Chair Holby, Representative Wingard, as I said, if the Dash 3 amendment to 328 is passed, the reality is that we would probably not be able to succeed in any case brought against a debt collector simply because the burden of proof to establish intent is so high. So if it is this committee's intent to make sure that the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act is enforced, if you impose upon us the duty to prove intent, you will have failed because we will not be able to enforce the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pete, just real quick, when this was brought to me, and the reason we're even hearing this bill, it was to get in on some litigation that would be going on nationwide, is what I was understood, to go after people outside of the state. And I'm just wondering, would this stop your ability from getting in on class action lawsuits? Because that's what Attorney General Kroger had told me, he was wanting to go after class action lawsuits that are already out there and to bring revenue for the state, is what I'm thinking, against these companies. And intent still allows him to be involved in those class action lawsuits, if I'm not correct.
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, theoretically we would have the ability to join nationwide cases. But as I've mentioned to Representative Wingard, because the standard of intent is so difficult, we probably would not join those cases because we wouldn't be able to prove intent, even though we're legally allowed to bring an action against a foreign company. And it would complicate things quite substantially. For example, Washington and California, our neighboring states, do not require intent as part of a predicate act in proving a violation of their unlawful debt collection statutes. So if we were to join with them, it would complicate the case quite substantially because we would be having to discover evidence of intent and prove intent, whereas they would not need to discover that evidence nor prove intent. And as a consequence, they frankly wouldn't want to be joining in a case with us. The cases are so substantially different when you're having to prove intent.
Follow up, Chair?
Follow up.
What are the federal standards? If we were to maybe eliminate this altogether and just abide by what the federal standards are?
The federal standard is essentially the same as what we have presently in Oregon, and that is it's a per se violation. If you fail to comply with any provision of the Federal Debt Collection Practices Act, it's presumed to be a violation of the Act, obviously. There is a safe harbor for bona fide error in cases brought by the consumer, but that bona fide error exception does not apply to cases that are brought by the Federal Trade Commission or by states.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to back up just for a second and clarify where monies go in settling these cases. Is it true that civil penalty settlement money goes to the program or to the department, but criminal penalties after a judgment go to the general fund?
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, all civil penalties that are imposed by a court go to the general fund. They do not go to the department, whether it's criminal, which we very, very rarely, as a matter of fact, I can't think of a criminal proceeding that we've brought under the UTPA. I'm not even sure we can. But civil penalties that are imposed by a court under the UTPA go to the general fund.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up. Is there a difference between pretrial settlement and settlement money in the civil side?
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, yes. If we resolve the case before going to litigation with what we call an AVC, an assurance of voluntary compliance, those monies go to in what's called the CP&E account to fund consumer education. And, for example, right now we're working on foreclosure relief and those kind of consumer education programs.
Okay, that's helpful.
Representative Widener.
Last one, Chair, I promise. With the case that we had against Freightliner, where we had sued Freightliner, do you think if we would have had intent in the language then that they might still be here today? Because you wouldn't have prosecuted the case successfully?
Sure, Holy Representative Widener. I'm not sure what case against Freightliner you're referencing. I know that there is a pending suit seeking to recover the state's portion of the punitive damages. Is that the case that you're in?
Correct.
Yeah. Intent is not a part of that statute, and I'm not sure how it would play because the punitive damages recovery is an action between a civil plaintiff and Freightliner. The state didn't play any role in that litigation at all.
Thank you. Not seeing any other questions at this time, so I appreciate your testimony. Before you go, though, maybe I do have another question. It was brought up about, out-of-state collection agencies, so maybe I just want to touch on that. I had asked a question previous that about the number of collection agencies in the state, how many were out of state, and I passed that out to the committee. The response I got from DCBS, and it did note that there are 767 total collection agencies registered. 150 of them are Oregon collection agencies, and 617 are out of state. So Mr. Dubanovich, I guess my question is, Senate Bill 328 will, from my understanding, give the Attorney General the ability to enforce Oregon law on some of these out-of-state collection agencies that break our laws here in Oregon.
Chair Holvey, you're absolutely correct. The Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act and the Unlawful Trade Practices Act both apply, if 328 is passed, both apply to out-of-state debt collection agencies. And we have no trouble enforcing the law against companies that are headquartered out of this state if they do business in this state. And as the committee is aware, a vast majority of the complaints that we receive about unlawful debt collection practices involve companies that are non-Oregon based. So what this statute will allow us to do is to be able to enforce the law against those non-Oregon companies that are violating Oregon law.
So to further clarify that, currently without, you know, right now, without Senate Bill 328 passing, without bringing this into law, the Attorney General could not enforce the Unlawful Debt Collection Act on out-of-state collection agencies that do business in Oregon?
Chair Holvey, unfortunately, you're right. Pretty much the most that we can do right now is send them a letter with a copy of the complaint that we received from the consumer. And hope that the consumer is able to resolve the complaint directly with the business, and if the business simply ignores the consumer, our hands are essentially tied at this point in time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Sam Krieger.
I've been real quiet. Trying to be good. Looking at the numbers, it appears that 75, maybe as high as 90% of the complaints are coming from out of state, and this body, or somebody, maybe Consumer Protection, allowed those out-of-state companies to operate out-of-state by filing a $15,000 bond, I believe. So if we did away with that, we'd do away with 75 to 80% of our complaints. And what I was asking, and I have not got an answer, out of those Oregon companies, does anybody have the statistics to see, are all these 150 that are in Oregon, are they all kind of doing this? Or is it just two or three that we're trying to regulate? And if you got rid of the out-of-state ones, it appears you've got the authority to deal with the ones in-state now.
Chair Holvey, Representative Krieger, I'm not sure how constitutional it would be for us to simply prohibit non-Oregon businesses to do business in Oregon. That's a question for a later day. But even if you were allowed to do that, there are two points I'd like to comment. First, it is my belief that a vast majority of the collection agencies in the state of Oregon are complying with Oregon law. That's the good news. The bad news is, if 328 is not passed, we can't go after the small number of Oregon companies that violate Oregon law. We simply don't have the tools to do so unless you allow us to use the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to go against any company, whether it's an Oregon company or a Kansas company, that is violating the Oregon Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
Got a letter dated March 30th from Department of Consumer Protection where it says that we have the ability to suspend, revoke registrations, collection agencies that have been engaged in dishonest, fraudulent, illegal practices or conduct of any kind.
I'm not sure what you're referring to. I'm sorry, Chair Holvey, Representative Krieger.
There's a letter here from Consumer Protection. They've all got it. That says, bottom paragraph, that we have the ability to suspend, revoke registration of a collection agency that has been engaged in a dishonest, fraudulent, or illegal practice of conduct of any kind. So if they can do that, and you're referring to that we couldn't regulate people not to have business, that's not what the $15,000 bond does. It allows them to operate without having a office or a responsible party in Oregon. And only when we allowed them with the $15,000 bond to be in Massachusetts and go through Oregon, they could still do it, but they'd have to have someone here in state. that you had access to. And it was only after we changed the law that we picked up this other 500 and some debt collectors, and they seem to be the majority of them. And, you know, Consumer Protection says they've got the authority to do all those things I just listed right now.
Chair Holby, Representative Krieger, I believe he's referring to, I don't have it in front of me, the letter from DCBS, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And just to be fair, I'll finish that paragraph.
I've read it, but they're saying at the top they can do this, and at the bottom they muddy the ground again. I'm not understanding what
well,
their problem
is. Well, it goes on to say that, but this does not mean we have regulatory authority over all types of wrongful practices. We have no more regulatory authority over debt collection practices than we have over tax fraud on wage and hour violations or identity theft, even though any of these theoretically might constitute grounds for revocation or suspension in an egregious case. You know, this is the power that the Department of Consumer and Business Services have, but clearly for an out-of-state company, they're saying they cannot, and I
that's
believe...
Right, out-of-state companies.
They cannot make this happen, you know. I don't think they have a history of revoking or suspending licenses from out-of-state companies. And so I think that's a statement to... is relatively clear, but it's unfortunate you don't have this to read. I don't know that the committee wants to take the time for you to read it or not.
It's okay. Chair Holby, my recollection is that DCBS has previously testified, whether it's in this committee or in the Senate, that they do not enforce the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. Their primary supervision of debt collection agencies is the relationship between the debt collection agency and the company they're working for. They do not regulate the relationship between the debt collection agency and the consumer. And I want to reemphasize also a point that was made earlier in the session, that DCBS does not have any regulatory control over what are called debt buyers. And unless you pass 328, debt buyers are going to continue to violate our Debt Collection Practices Act. Even though DCBS has control over debt collection agencies, they do not regulate debt buyers. And those folks who are predominantly out of state continue to have a substantial number of the problems that we're facing in Oregon.
Yes, and I thank you for bringing that up. I mean, that was a big piece of this issue, is the first-party collectors and the debt buyers, that DCBS doesn't regulate them because they're not required to be licensed, for one, and DCBS doesn't enforce, as you've mentioned, the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. So I appreciate your comments. I appreciate your willingness to answer all of these questions. I'm not seeing any other questions. And so the motion's been made. I'd like a vote on the motion, please, if you give me a roll call vote.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
No.
Representative Barton?
No.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
No.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
No.
Representative Zillian?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
No.
Chair Holby?
No. The amendment, having not received the required votes, is failed.
Mr. Chair, I move
Tomei.
Senate Bill 328 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 328 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly to say thank you for your patience and indulgence on the other amendment. I'll be voting for this measure with a slight reservation that I could vote no on the floor. I appreciate it.
So noted. May I have the roll call vote, please?
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. Senate Bill 328, having received the required votes, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The chair will carry this bill. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 328. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2268. Victoria, would you give us a brief description of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2268 requires vehicle repair shops to prepare estimate of work as specified and obtain owner's or owner designee's approval before proceeding with repairs. Authorizes enforcement of violation as unlawful trade practice. You will remember the committee did adopt the Dash 1 amendments on Wednesday, which limit application to personal vehicles, exempt frame and body shops, reduce estimate requirements and parts and warranty disclosures, increase minimum cost for applicability from $100 to $200, reduce record-keeping requirements from 3 years to 1 year, allow consumers to waive authorization requirements in writing after full disclosure.
Thank you. Committee, we've previously heard this bill, and it has been carried over, but I wanted to give an opportunity for the Department of Justice and the Daryl Fuller, if you wish to make any comments as well. Boy.
Yelling things and from the
yeah,
back.
Yeah.
And the chair concurs. Department of Justice, do you wish to make any comments on this, or it's pretty well done?
I'm just going to go out there.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2268 and open a work session on House Bill 2268. I'd entertain a motion. The amendment has already been adopted, so the motion would reflect the amendment. So adopted.
Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move House Bill 2268 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 2268 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing no discussion, could I have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Maynard?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2268, having received the required votes, is declared passed. Anybody like to carry that particular bill? Repair shops? Representative Widener.
We have to prep some extra hard questions.
With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2268. Committee, we are going to carry over House Bill 2658 until Wednesday. We will not be meeting on Monday, for your information, so you won't see me in this committee room.
Or any other.
All right. I hope not.
Mr. Chair, you open the meeting together on Monday someplace?
I did some checking.
I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.